Hopefully, I've made clear the distinction between capital goods and consumers' goods. Let me just stress that what makes something a capital good is not anything physical about the good. It's nothing inherent in the good. It's the purpose for which the good is purchased, whether to bring in subsequent sales or not. That's the distinction. And the identical physical goods can be capital goods in one context and consumers' goods in another. I've already had a couple of examples, like the roast beef purchased by a restaurant, that's a capital good. The roast beef purchased by a housewife, that's a consumer's good. All of the boxes of breakfast cereal that are on the shelves of supermarkets, what are they? It's capital goods for the supermarkets. It'll be consumer's goods when purchased by the housewives. The supermarket has bought these boxes for what purpose? To make sales at a profit. And when it sells them, it can then rebuy them from the wholesaler. When the housewives buy them, their funds are used up and gone. They need an outside source of revenue. Now, sometimes you'll find people describing capital goods as synonymous with machinery and factories and so forth. That's not really true. There are many, many machines that are consumers' goods. Try to think of various machines that I'm sure practically all of you own that are consumers' goods, not capital goods. Your personal automobile, your personal computer, a blender, a microwave oven, your refrigerator, a CD player, a DVD player, your washing machine and dryer at home, a dishwasher at home, those are consumers' goods. Can you think of any tools that are consumers' goods that virtually all of us have? A hammer and a screwdriver. Knives and forks are implements. The food that we have in our refrigerator and pantries, those are materials of physical production, but they're all consumers' goods. Now, you can have some gigantic machines that are consumers' goods. We've been using as examples things like washing machines, perhaps sewing machines. Occasionally, you might find a home hobbyist who has a lathe in his workshop, maybe a bandsaw, God knows what. Well, if he's using that equipment just to make items for use around his house or to give as gifts at Christmas time or whatever, what's the character of such a lathe and such a bandsaw? They're consumers' goods. Now, to take an even bigger illustration, the Army Corps of Engineers has some incredible construction equipment, huge earth-moving equipment. What's its nature? What is the purpose for which these things are employed? Are they employed for the purpose of earning revenue and profit?
No.
So they're consumers' goods. They physically wear out. Ultimately, they'll have to be replaced. Thus, the activities of the Army Corps of Engineers provide the funds that make possible the replacement of its equipment?
No.
So it's consumption. Now, this same distinction that applies between consumers' goods and capital goods also applies to labor. And here the distinction is from the point of view of the buyer, from the point of view of the employer of labor, labor employed for the purpose of the employer making sales, that's producer's labor. We could call it capital labor, but the conventional terminology would be producer's labor. Labor employed not for the purpose of making subsequent sales, but for any other purpose, that's consumer's labor. And again, you can have a physically identical labor that's consumer's labor in one context, producer's labor in another. Imagine, for example, a maid who's employed by a hotel. The hotel pays the maid's wages for the purpose of having clean rooms to induce guests to come to the hotel. So the maid employed by hotel is producer's labor. The money that's paid to her as wages, that's a productive expenditure. And by virtue of employing a maid, the hotel brings in paying guests that provide it with money that enable it to continue the maid's employment. Employing the maid for a hotel is the source of funds that makes it possible to maintain the employment of the maid, and to the extent there's a profit, do more. Now suppose on one day a week, that same maid does the exact same kind of work, but for a housewife. Well, the housewife, in that context, the maid represents consumer's labor. The expenditure of the wages for the maid are used up and gone. In order to make it possible to continue her employment, the housewife needs some separate source of funds. The employment of the maid does not bring in the funds to make possible her continued employment. Yes, Mr. Holm.
So I'm still not clear on the question about the not-for-profit companies. Like, if they were to make expenditures, would that be considered consumption or production?
All right, a nonprofit organization makes expenditures to carry out its mission. The Red Cross is making expenditures to provide relief to disaster victims. Okay, what do you think is the nature of the expenditure?
Because it's not for profit or it's not for sales, then I guess it would be consumption.
It's consumption, and if that is all that the Red Cross is doing, what would happen to its ability to continue in operation? In order for the Red Cross to keep up its work, what must they have? They need contributors. They need donors. Does their activities, does their disaster relief provide the funds? Does the Red Cross have a meeting and say, well, I know how we're going to make a ton of money. We're going to spend a fortune helping disaster victims. No. Now, that might induce other people to contribute money, but that's not a sales revenue. Let me give you a simple example. I subscribe to the Orange County Opera Performing Arts Center, and I pay a subscription each year in exchange for tickets. Now, when I get the tickets, I typically also get a request for an additional donation. If I give them a donation, that's not part of their sales revenue. I'm not paying it in exchange for the tickets. I'm paying it to help them out. It's not a sales revenue. When people are contributing to the Red Cross to do its work, they're not the customers of the Red Cross. They're donors. They're supporters. They're not customers. The Red Cross, etc., needs donors. Why does it need donors?
Continue doing its
play. Listen, the money that it expends in its regular operations is all consumed. To continue to spend such money, it needs an outside source of funds, namely the donors. The money that they're spending is not itself bringing in the money to make possible the continuation. They need donors who will contribute because they want the Red Cross to continue its work. It's not earning the money in the course of performing its activities. Yes, Mr. King.
About expenditures to salespeople. I don't know what you call them, looking to procure more donors.
Well, now salespeople by whom?
Red Cross's folks. Cold calling, sending them
money. Yeah. Well, see, they're asking people to contribute, not to buy something. They're asking people support money. Look, what do you say? Is it a housewife's job? Is her job description that she asks her husband for money? No, that's not a job. That's not a job. Her actual work is doing whatever she's doing. That's not earning money. But in order to continue what she's doing, she needs money. It's not the work that's bringing in the money. It's a contribution, a support. And it's similar with a nonprofit organization. Their actual work in the field is not a source of funds. That's why they need contributors. That's why they need fundraising campaigns. Because the money they have is expended and gone. It's consumption. In order to be continued, they need an outside source of funds. Now, people may want to promote that activity. They contribute to promote the activity, but they're not customers, they're supporters.
So is like when I say the capital goods that they have, like let's say they have an airplane that flies them to Asia to help Sonoma, is that a capital?
Well, what do you think? They bought an airplane. They're using the airplane to fly supplies to disaster victims.
But they're still doing that to get to their point.
They're doing it to achieve their objective, but now, does that make it possible to maintain the airplane, to replace it? The activity doesn't. It's consumption. And in order to make possible their continued activities, they need to turn to outside supporters. They need to go to people to say, look, this is what we're doing. We can't continue it without you. If all we did was spend the money we've spent for the purposes we're trying to achieve, we'd use up the money. We'd be out. So will you please help us out? Well, the people who are helping them out are not customers, they're contributors. They're donating money to make possible the continued consumption activity of this operation.
So, to follow on what Brendan was saying, it's the determining factors are not only the intent, but the self-sustaining factor, whether they are or are not self-sustaining.
Well, only if their intent is to earn revenue can they be self-sustaining. If you are doing something and the intent is not to earn revenue, how likely is it that you'll have the revenue? You won't have it. You'll be expending money for some purpose you want to achieve. You've spent the money. Now it's gone. Where do you go from there? You won't be able to have money to repeat the activity by virtue of the activity itself. You then need to turn to people to give you fresh money to continue. You're not self-sustaining. And you can't be self-sustaining unless your intent was to bring in revenue.
Right.
Yes, Ms. Petterson.
No, I was just going to look at it like you are consuming money to turn it around and pass it on, I guess, in a different form. Not money, but in goods, services, yeah.
Okay, you want to help disaster victims.
Mm-hmm.
People see innocent victims of disaster, it makes them feel very bad. They'll feel better if they help these people. So they pay money for it. Okay, that's consumption. And in order to make that possible, again, you need to pay more. Yes, Ms. Bonanno.
So the purpose there and the differentiator is that their purpose is to sustain consumption.
Yeah, their purpose—they're sustaining—they're sustaining an activity. They make possible the continuation of the consumption.
Right. Versus the having something that produces a profit or to sustain the operation, they're really just sustaining consumption of the activity.
They're providing the funds to make possible continued consumption. I don't know if this would be a good example. Let's assume. Here we are, there's the tsunami victims, and the Red Cross is going to help them. And there's also business suppliers that are going to provide construction materials or whatever. Or they're delivering food supplies. But they're delivering them for business purposes. They're delivering them as they're making sales. Well, do these business firms have to have fundraising events? No, they recoup the funds in their business operations. The Red Cross or whatever, they need the fundraisers because the money they've spent does not come back in the course of their normal operations. Disaster relief does not provide funds for the continuation of disaster relief. There have to be people who are looking out, seeing the disaster relief, saying, yes, I approve, therefore I'll contribute. But it's not the activity of disaster relief itself. You don't say, boy, the Red Cross, that's really a hot business to be in. I'm going into that line, and I'm going to make a fortune. I don't think that's how we can view it. Yes, Mr. Sadowski.
I wanted to just go back to the consumer labor example you gave before regarding the maid working for the housewife.
Yeah.
I understand that she wouldn't, as far as the housewife, not using her to make subsequent sales, basically just keeping her house up or whatever. But mm-hmm. What about the maid? Because she would be paying her, so would she be considered like a, I don't know, would that be considered producer's labor, say she had her own business?
You're talking about the maid now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Could you use that? You kind of threw it in there, and I was.
Okay, that's a good question. From the perspective of the maid or any worker who is being paid They're engaged in productive activity. They're earning money. The distinction between producer's labor and consumer's labor is from the perspective of the employer. It's the same thing as the distinction between capital goods and consumer's goods. The firms that produce consumer's goods, they're engaged in production, they're making money, their activity is productive, but the person who's buying the consumer's goods, he's consuming. Yes, Mr. Joseph.
I'm still having some trouble seeing this from your perspective.
Okay.
In regards to the nonprofit, I mean, I understand that the nonprofit, this disaster relief that it's giving is a consumptive activity.
Okay.
But its existence is productive to the extent that the donors, whose real intention for donating that money is to receive a service, and they expect a return on the money that they invest in that company. That's why nonprofits have financial statements, why they're run by business professionals who actually do make very good money in many cases. You know, receive salaries of hundreds of thousands of dollars a year running these.
They're very high salaried people, perhaps running some of these organizations.
It is a very lucrative profession. Okay. Working at a nonprofit.
For some of the employees, yes. But now you use the expression people expecting a return on their investment.
Yes.
I don't think that that's true. You're using it in a very metaphorical sense. They're expecting satisfaction for the money that they're contributing. That we could say, that when you contribute to one of these organizations, you're doing it to achieve some satisfaction. But what is the return on your investment? Here you are, you contributed $1,000. How much money are you getting back?
The productive work of the organization.
Well, you're getting the satisfaction from seeing them carry out their mission. You are not getting a return in dollars and cents. You're not getting a return on investment in terms of dollars and cents.
You are. You're receiving a service because, in effect, they're converting your money into something that you want to invest in.
Yes, but you always want something. When you buy an automobile, why do you buy an automobile? You could say, okay, I'm getting return on my investment. Not really. You're getting satisfaction from your use of the car.
Foundations, all they do is invest your money wisely.
Well, no, wait.
Spend your money wisely for you. Towards causes that...
Okay, let's say they're spending money on your behalf for things that you want. Well, so do you and I every day. When you buy dinner, when you buy a car, a suit, whatever, we're buying everything we buy for the satisfaction we get from buying it, for whatever good we judge that it does us. So we're getting something for the money we spend, but we're not getting money for the money we spend. That's the critical difference. Are we spending money to get money back, or are we spending money for the sake of some satisfaction? If we're spending money merely for the sake of a satisfaction, the money we have spent is used up and gone. For the activity to be continued, it needs a fresh donation of money. That's the difference. We have to consider, is the return a monetary return? Only monetary returns make it possible to have self-sustaining activity. Mere satisfaction does not.
So the interior designer, is her business productive?
It's productive for her, yes. Now, the party paying her is engaged in consumption.
She's consuming your money.
Pardon me?
She's consuming your money for you.
Oh, you mean the interior designer acting as an agent. But she's not a charitable organization. She's in business. She's performing a service. She's getting paid for her service. And part of the service is she acts as your purchasing agent. That's part of what she's doing.
Okay, but you don't make money by giving her your money.
No, you're not. You're the consumer, but she's making money by acting on your behalf.
So is the nonprofit organization.
No, look, General Motors sells you cars. When you buy a General Motors car as a consumer, you're still a consumer, but they're making money. Lots of businesses make lots of money by selling to consumers. But the consumers are still consumers. The consumers are not making the money when they buy the consumer's goods. The sellers are making the money. That's the distinction. The interior designer, she's getting paid for a service. To some degree, she's buying furniture for her customer, and maybe she gets a commission on that. So she's making money, but the party employing her, unless it's a business, if it's a homeowner employing her, it's consumption. Their consumption is the source of her income.
very analogous to a nonprofit organization.
Well, the nonprofit organization, the people who are getting...
I don't mean to take this.
Okay. Okay, maybe we need to do that. Okay. We could talk further, because I do want to go on to some further things. Now, just let me say a few words why I say the government is a consumer. And the government provides the greatest example of employing consumers' labor. The government has a mass of employees. I think all the different branches of government employ perhaps on the order of 16 million people, if I'm not mistaken. So it's a huge employer. And government employment is far and away the leading example of consumers' labor. Now, why are the employees of government to be considered as consumers' labor? And why are the goods that the government buys to be considered as consumers' goods? They don't generate revenue. The government spends money to meet its payroll, buy the various goods, and then what must the government do if it wants to continue its operations? They have to turn to the taxpayers, or possibly print it too, but primarily the taxpayers. Now, why does the government need to turn to taxpayers? Because it doesn't bring in revenue from its own activities. It's a consumer. It's a massive consumer. It spends the funds that it has. And then to have fresh funds, it has to get those funds from an outside source, not its own activities. And those that outside source is the taxpayers. The very fact that the government has to turn to taxpayers is a proof that it's a consumer. The very fact that the nonprofits have to turn to donors is a proof that they're consumers. Yes, Ms. Petters.
Is it true then to say productive consumption is consumption for the purpose of production? That's a true statement.
Yeah, when we talk of productive consumption, we're talking in a context before the division of labor, and that would be correct. Now, what's the counterpart of productive consumption in the division of labor economy is productive expenditure. We're spending money for the purpose of bringing in money. So we bring in the same sort of thing in a greater quantity. It's productive and reproductive. We're bringing in the same sort of thing that we expend. Yes, Mr. Doe.
What would employees for the government be classified
as? Consumers' labor. Consumers' labor. They're employed, and they're not bringing in money to the government. They depend, their continued employment depends on an outside source of funds. Yes, Ms. Buckles.
Well, the consumer would approve of the government and of, like, the Red Cross, correct? Because they're consuming, but they're not producing.
Now, does the taxpayer approve of the government the way a contributor to the Red Cross approves of the Red Cross? Mm-hmm. What do you think? When you paid your last taxes, was it because you said, boy, that government is doing one hell of a job, let me write them a check?
But they maintain our
well, they do certain things, yes. But why is it that you're paying your taxes?
Because we have to.
What happens if you don't? You'll go to jail. So I think the effective reason that people are paying their taxes is not because they want to promote some satisfaction or whatever. They're paying under threat of going to jail. Yes, Mr. Doe.
So police officers only produce labor?
All right, police officers. All right, what do you think?
Consumers' labor.
They're consumers' labor. Now, what?
About tickets.
Pardon me? Okay. All right, that's true. They do give out tickets. But and that is taking in a source of money, yes. And you could also give a bigger example. The IRS takes in tons of money, but is that producer's labor? Just think, there are certain additional elements involved. In order for the concept of producer's labor or any exchange relationship implies that the parties are engaged in voluntary exchange. We have a context where people are engaged in voluntary exchange. So now, when you pay a parking ticket, are you saying, boy, I like the way that cop rides his motorcycle. I want to pay this ticket. Are you paying a parking ticket the way you buy a movie ticket? No. What's the difference between a parking ticket and a movie ticket?
Satisfaction.
You buy the movie ticket because you positively want to see the movie. You're getting some positive benefit, so you buy the movie ticket. Why are you paying the parking ticket? It's because you're getting the positive benefit of being apprehended for speeding. No, you're not buying anything. You're paying a fine. You're paying a penalty. You're paying something that you would rather not pay. You're paying it against your will under the threat of more severe punishment.
You're getting an exchange to speed or whatever the switch is of some benefit.
It's not an exchange. It's not an exchange. I mean, yes.
So what are you saying, that there has to be a demand for that service or product?
It has to be something that people freely buy, that they can buy or not buy, and they're paying money to obtain the thing in exchange. Yes, Mr. Rocchetti.
And how would you classify the post office labor?
Okay.
They're actually out to make a profit, but they're government employees.
Well, are they out to make a profit? You see,
pardon me?
Now, you see, it gets a little complicated. The post office does sell a lot of stamps, so they do have considerable revenues. But what is the purpose of the post office? Suppose you had to make a choice. The purpose of the post office is A, to make sales at a profit, B, to deliver the people's mail. I'd say their purpose is to deliver the mail, and when you have something specific as the purpose to achieve it, what do you expect to have to incur? Expenses. You have to pay money to achieve the objective. So fundamentally, government enterprises, which are not there for the purpose of making money, they're there to carry out certain defined objectives. They're essentially consumers. Now, there can be circumstances where they do take in more money than they pay out, although that's quite rare, but it could occasionally happen. But I would say still the basic nature is they're consumers. I don't consider this too important a case. You know, there's the phenomenon of borderline cases. There's nothing clearer, I think, than the concepts day and night. But if we start focusing on a particular moment of the dawn or dusk, we may be hard-pressed to say, well, does this moment belong to the daytime or the nighttime? And we couldn't say. And it's possible that something like the post office is of that character. It's not terrifically clear-cut, given all of their revenues. And maybe at one time or another, they have revenues greater than their costs, but that's not too likely. If they had to operate under the same conditions as a normal business, they almost certainly couldn't have revenues greater than their costs. The post office doesn't pay any local property taxes or sales taxes or anything of that kind. It has a monopoly on the delivery of first-class mail. So it's not in a normal position. But if you want to say, okay, the post office, its expenditures are productive expenditures, I don't think it's too big a deal one way or the other. Now, the IRS, I would say, would not, its outlays, its payroll, I would dispute very hotly as not being a productive expenditure. And the analogy I would use is, suppose we have a gang of safecrackers. They buy a getaway car, they buy some nitroglycerin, they blow some safes, and the proceeds that they get out of the safes far surpasses the money they've expended to pull the job. So is their outlay productive expenditure? I would say no. We'd be dropping the context that productive expenditure exists in a context in which the revenues are going to come in voluntary exchange for a product or service, where people are parting with money in exchange for a product or service. Yes?
Technicality.
Covering your car insurance?
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Beat that one.
Well, there are cases where you have much higher rates. You don't have to go to California car insurance. How about $20 Tylenol tablets in hospitals?
Yeah.
I think that's more egregious. Now, I would say that this is not the outcome of the normal functioning of a market. It's the result of extensive government interference. But to go into that, that's a major discussion itself. I do have extensive discussion on the medical situation, I think in somewhere in chapter 10, if anyone is interested. It's not part of this course, though. Okay, now I have on this supplement a brief mention of the concepts of imputed income and opportunity cost, but I'm going to skip over them, at least for now. Maybe we'll come back to them next week, or if we get a lot further ahead than is likely tonight. I want to turn to the subjects of aggregate production and aggregate spending. And we want to start off by dealing with the question, what is actually produced in the economic system? What's the total of production? The concept of gross domestic product would appear to aim at measuring total production. Gross domestic product, you think, is the total product of the economic system. And that's what it should be from the name. And so we want to start off by discussing what belongs under the concept gross product, the totality of what's produced in a country in a year. There are actually very different views on this subject, and I'm going to begin with the view of the classical economists, which is the view that I share, and then we'll turn to the more popular contemporary view. And we can bring out the essential points in terms of an example, the production of wheat, flour, and bread. Here we are, we have periods of time. We could perhaps use years if we wanted. We have, in each period, there's a production of wheat. Starting in the second period, we look at the production of flour, and from the third period on, the production of bread. Now, I have downward sloping arrows showing that X1 of wheat, which is produced in period 1, is going to be productively consumed in producing Y1 sacks of flour in period 2. And those Y1 sacks of flour, in their turn, will be productively consumed in producing Z1 loaves of bread in period 3. And thereafter, certainly by the time we get to period 3, we have not only the Z1 loaves being produced, we have a fresh Y2 sacks of flour, a fresh X3 bushels of wheat. They're all being produced. And you can think of this as representing a year. And let's consider for a moment, let's take the year 2004 as our year. If I ask you, what was the total produced with respect to bread, flour, and wheat in 2004? How would you answer that question? Would you say, pardon me?
Was 3 2004 or 4?
Let's say 3 is 2004. Exactly. If this is 2004, and I ask you, what is the gross output of year four, of 2004? Well, the X3 bushels of wheat are produced in 2004, the Y2 sacks of flour, and the Z1 loaves of bread. Now, just think for a moment. Last year, isn't it true that so many million loaves of bread were produced in the United States? Isn't it also true that so many million sacks of flour were produced? And isn't it also true that so many million bushels of wheat were grown? And I would say, yeah, this is. These things were all produced. They're all part of the gross product. And similarly, so many million tons of iron ore were extracted. So many million tons of steel were produced. So many million automobiles and refrigerators were produced. Were all these things produced? I would say without question, all of these things were produced. Now, this is exactly what people like Adam Smith would say and James Mill, that this is the gross product. Well, what happens to much of the gross product? In fact, most of the gross product. What happens to all of the wheat that's produced? It's productively consumed in making flour. What happens to the flour that's produced? It's productively consumed in making bread. So we have a huge amount of production, but a huge part of that production ends up in productive consumption. Now, So let's keep in mind, we have, first off, this concept of gross product that includes the production of everything. The wheat, the flour, the bread, the iron ore, the steel, and the automobiles. That's the gross product. And then we recognize that a huge part of the gross product, maybe most of it, is productively consumed. Now, when you subtract from the production of something the necessary productive consumption, what you have is the net product, the gain from production. The gain, you see, to produce flour, you have to productively consume wheat. To produce bread, you have to productively consume flour. The net product entailed in the production of flour, the net product is the flour minus the wheat, with the wheat representing all of the inputs. That's the net product. But the gross product is the flour. The gross product is flour. The net product is flour minus wheat. The net product of the bakers is bread minus flour. But the gross product of the bakers is what? It's bread. So everybody produces his gross product, but to produce his gross product, they have to have productive consumption, and the net product is the gross product minus the productive consumption. That's the net product. Now let's try to keep that in mind. We have these three concepts: gross product, productive consumption, and net product.
So could you net product for a minute?
The net product is the difference between the gross product and productive consumption. It's the difference between the product produced and the previously produced things that you have to use up to produce it. The simplest examples are: the net product of the baker is bread minus flour. The net product of the miller is flour minus wheat. That's the net product. Yes, Mr. Tell.
If we got multiple parts, like for example, a car. Cars are steel as the glasses. So the net of the car will be the car minus the glasses, car minus the steel, right?
If you were thinking of net product in automobiles, it would essentially be the automobile minus the steel. The steel along with everything else. I refer to one input, one leading input, but everything else in the same position would be included. So the net product of the baker is bread minus flour, but also the butter, the yeast, whatever else is required to produce the bread. The net product of the automobile firm is the automobile minus not only the steel, but also the tires, the paint, the plate glass, whatever. It's all of the previously produced inputs. Yes, Mr. Gandhar.
So net product is equal to gross product minus consumption.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Holm.
And so, gross product would be bushels of wheat, sacks of flour, loaves of bread together.
Yeah, that's the gross product, and the net product, would be whatever is used up to produce these things. So, if we wanted to calculate the net product in year three, the net product. Okay, the gross product is X3 plus Y2 plus Z1, right? That's the gross product. Mm-hmm. Now, what is required to produce the Z1?
Y1.
We have a productive consumption of Y1. And what's required to produce the Y2?
X2.
A productive consumption of X2. So now, could you state I'll go to the board. Tell me how to write the net product of year three. Okay, it's X3 plus Y2 plus Z1, that's the gross product, minus
X2 plus
Y1. Minus X2 and minus Y1.
Oh.
This would be the net product. Now, we can simplify this. We could say that the net product is X3 minus X2 plus Y2 minus Y1 plus Z1. And this will be the net product. Yes, Mr. Drew?
Question. Is this analogous to saying that, you know, cost of goods sold, versus gross sales kind of thing, the cost of doing business for your product?
You mean to get to net product?
Yes.
Okay, the way you calculate net product is you have the sales revenue, and then what you would subtract is not the cost of goods sold, but something smaller than that, smaller in some ways, perhaps larger in others. It would be the cost on account of previously purchased inputs, previously produced inputs. So just think, if our paradigm is the net product of an automobile firm is the cars minus the steel and everything at the level of the steel, we take the sales revenues of the auto firm and subtract what? Would we subtract all of the costs? Pardon me?
Sorry,
just
the cost of goods.
You say the cost of goods sold?
Well, product. The car.
Well, the car is the sales revenue. I'm asking, what do we subtract?
The
and that would give us. I'm sorry?
The finished products going into the car?
Like tires.
The tires, the steel, all of the items purchased from other business firms. All of the items purchased from other business firms. So it would be the steel, the tires, the paint, the plate glass, any components. But what major component of cost would we not be counting as part of the labor? We'd omit the wages. The net product ends up being equal to the sum of the profits and wages together. The net product is the profits and wages together. Yes, Mr. Gandhar.
Yes. Is the reason X1 is not calculated now is because it's already been correctly consumed by one?
Well, we're dealing with the net product just of period three. So if we're looking at the net product of period two, the net product of period two would be X2 plus Y1 minus X1. That's of period two.
So is the net product then equal to the consumer product?
Oh, a very good observation. Is the net product equal to the consumer's good? Pretty much. Let's just look right here. What do we have? This is the consumer's good, and these two items, what this represents is the net change in inventory of these intermediate products. What would happen if X3 and X2 were equal, and Y2 and Y1 were equal? They're not going to be radically different. If X3 and X2 and Y2 and Y1 were equal, then what would be the net product?
Just Z1.
Now, if you look at things sequentially, we're looking at everything within year three. But suppose we looked at things sequentially. What is the net product in producing Y1? What's the net product entailed in producing Y1?
X1.
X2 minus X1.
X2 plus Y1.
Here we are. Here's
X1.
Y1. Here's
X1.
Y1.
Y1 minus X1.
Y1 minus X1 would be the net product in producing the flour. Now, what's the net product in producing the initial wheat?
X1.
It's just X1. We don't want an infinite regress, so we'll assume there's no productive consumption to make the wheat, just to put an end to things. So the net product of producing the wheat, that's X1. The net product of producing the flour is Y1 minus X1. What's the net product of producing the Z1 loaves of bread?
Z1
minus Y1. Okay, now, what do all of these things reduce to?
Z1.
It'll simplify to Z1. See, notice, here's plus X1, here's minus X1. Plus Y1, minus Y1. The net product works out, if we look at it sequentially, so the net product works out to be the final product. The net product is the final product. If we're looking at things all within one period of time, then the net product is a little more than just the consumer's good. It's the consumer's good plus any net change in inventory of the other things. Yes, Mr. Alekis.
So the overall purpose then to not count the input of materials more than once, I mean, your finished product, so you're not adding to the gross national product?
Well, that's the question we're going to deal with. We're going to deal with the question of what needs to be counted. So what have we said is the gross product? What's the gross product of period three?
C1.
Is that the gross product?
No.
Z1 would be the net product.
Net product.
Well,
yeah.
Z1 plus the change in interest. But what's the gross product of period three?
X3 plus Y2 plus Z1.
It's X3 plus Y2 plus Z1. That's the gross product.
Okay.
Now, the problem that I see in contemporary aggregate economics is a huge confusion between the gross product and the net product. In contemporary economics, the net product is confused with the gross product. They take the net product as though it were the gross product. And I'll give you a demonstration of that. The way I put it in point three, as I say, contemporary Keynesian economics view of production as merely the gain from production, the net product, which it mistakenly regards as the gross product. Now, this is something, I'm going to say something which very understandably you might not want to believe or think I must be making up or that it's absurd. It is absurd, but I'm not making it up. In contemporary economics, it is believed that what a producer produces is not his simple common sense gross product. It's believed that what a baker produces, for example, is not bread. What a miller produces is not flour. Or what do you think it is that they allegedly produce? They're alleged to produce their net products, not their gross products. It's thought that what they're producing is their net product, and that's the total of production, the sum of the net products. Now, let me give you some immediate evidence of this. I refer in point A to alleged production of product differences. The product differences are the actual product minus the productive consumption, the net product, the bread minus the flour, for example. And now I quote a prominent author, I think he's no longer with us, his name was Lloyd G. Reynolds. He was a very well-known professor at Yale University for many years. He was the editor of the Dow Jones Irwin series of textbooks in economics. And here's what he has to say. And I'd appreciate very much someone being kind enough to read this quotation. It starts with "a farmer produces."
A farmer produces $100 worth of wheat, which is sold to a flour miller. The milling company, by adding labor and capital inputs to this raw material, produces flour, which it sells for $150. A baking company uses this flour to produce $225 worth of food.
Yep.
How much has the milling company produced? Not its sales revenue of $150, since $100 of this was really produced by the farmer. The milling company's output is the sales value of its product minus its purchases from the...
Let me get there in just a second.
Preceding stage of production. We call this the value added at the milling stage, which in this example is $50.
Okay, can you keep in mind what has just been said here? We're told that here's a flour miller. They produce a quantity of flour that sells for $150. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, if we thought of the product of the flour mill as flour, and we know the flour sells for $150, how would we describe the monetary value of the product of the flour mill? That's $150. We'd say the monetary value of their product is $150. Well, Professor Reynolds says that's really mistaken. He says, how much has the milling company produced? He says, not its sales revenue of $150, since 100 of this was really produced by the farmer. What then does he credit the milling company with producing?
$50.
So now that would be reasonable if I ask you, what is the monetary value of the net product of the flour mill? That would be $50. The net product is $50. That's perfectly reasonable. But the actual product, the gross product, that's $150, not $50. Well, in contemporary economics, as I say, there is this incredible confusion of thinking that what the producers produce is not their actual common sense gross products, but a conceptual abstraction, the difference between the products and the previously purchased inputs. In other words, the net product. It's thought that production is the gain from production. Now, sometimes this view occasionally might be reasonable. Suppose we ask, what does a tailor produce? Suppose you bring in a pair of slacks and you want the tailor to put cuffs on the slacks. How would we describe the product of the tailor in that situation?
Value of the labor to...
Well, the physical product. How would we describe the physical product of the tailor?
The finished.
The finished production.
Alteration.
Well, it would be an alteration. The tailor would be performing the alteration. His product would be the cuffs. And we'd say, okay, the tailor has just made cuffs. Now, in contemporary economics, the totality of production is regarded simply as alterations. It's thought that the company that produces the slacks is, in effect, just producing an alteration in the raw material. The company that produces the material is just producing an alteration of raw cotton, or whatever the fabric might be. That the automobile company is producing an alteration in the steel. That the steel is an alteration in the iron ore. And so it's thought that what everyone is producing is, in effect, a kind of alteration. And what he's producing is not the total product that emanates from his establishment, but the difference between that product and what he started with. That's how the view is held. Now, I hold that the product of a bakery is bread, the product of a flour mill is flour, the product of the wheat farmer is wheat, the total gross product is the sum of the three. I would say the net product is the sum of these differences, but that's not the gross product. In contemporary economics, however, the net product is treated as though it were the gross product. Yes, Mr. Holmes.
So is that assuming that the loaf of bread won't go any farther? That's assuming like the Subway won't then sell the bread.
Okay, now, good question. What about loaves of bread bought by Subway and other sandwich shops and so forth? All right, what is the final product there?
Sandwich.
It would be the sandwiches. So, and then the bread would be in the same position as the flour is in. Now, to change the example a little bit, sometimes people buy flour. When housewives buy flour in the supermarket, how will the flour be treated?
Waffles.
Pardon me?
Waffles. Isn't that what it's made for?
Well, the housewife might make waffles, but what is the final product that would go into the national income accounts?
The flour,
in that case, is final. It's the final product is the product that is purchased not for the purpose of making subsequent sales. It's the consumer's good. When a restaurant buys bread, the bread is not a final product. It's purchased to make the restaurant's product. So you can't take definite goods and say this good is always and forever a final product or not a final product. It depends on the purpose for which it's purchased. Yes, Mr. Ellicus.
Because we're talking about the sums of money that is accumulated or generated from the product.
Yeah.
Where does third-party type companies fit into that, or brokers, or distributors, people that buy and then resell the same exact product, buy a discount and resell at higher prices?
I know. Where brokers would fit in, like stockbrokers, I would say the gross product of the stockbroker is not the stocks he's buying and selling. It's simply the service he's performing. It's the brokerage service, and we would count it as the sum of the brokerage fees. Now, when you have wholesale operations, there the actual sales revenue would be the total proceeds. I would say if we have a bread wholesaler, I would count the sales revenues of the bakers and then also the sales revenues of the wholesaler.
Okay.
Okay, now.
Question.
Yes.
One more question.
Sure.
I just wanted to make the point clear. You say contemporary confused the net and the gross.
Yes.
And the Costco does not. And there are two different net. There's a net product for the period and a net product for the product.
No, there's a net product and a gross product.
Okay.
Right. That would be the basic distinction, the net product and the gross product. Now, in contemporary economics, what is being called the gross product is essentially a net product. And to give you some further evidence of this, there are two methods for measuring GDP. Two methods. You'll find this in any conventional textbook. They'll tell you there's two methods of measuring GDP. One is called the value of the final product method, and the other is called the sum of the values added. The sum of the values added. And both of those methods follow from the conception that what a producer produces is his net product, that what he's producing is the difference between his product and what he uses up in order to produce it. If that's what a producer produced, if that were what a producer produced, what would be the method of measuring his output? Pardon me?
Would add his profits and his wages.
The profits and the wages, but that would equal, that's the difference between the value of the gross product and the value of the previously produced means of production used up to produce it. So just think, if the product of the flour miller were not flour, but flour minus wheat, well, what's the way that you measure that? What? How would you measure that product? The value of the flour minus the value of the wheat, just the way Reynolds did it. So if that's what flour millers produced, flour minus wheat, then the appropriate measure is the difference, it's the value added. It's the difference between the value of the flour and the value of the wheat. But if we consider the product of the flour miller to be flour, if that's what we think of as the product, then what's the monetary counterpart of that? The value of the flour, the value of the flour. But in contemporary economics, it's thought that what the producers are producing are their net products rather than their gross products. And from that conception, one can say that the total production, the total net product, is the sum of all of the values added, or the value of the final product. Those would be the appropriate measures. Now, notice in that quotation from Reynolds, who produced the flour that the flour miller allegedly didn't? The farmer. This is what I mean when I, in point D, I refer to accompanying confusion of who produces what. Here's the flour mill. Up to now, before they were acquainted with Professor Reynolds, they were walking around thinking that they're producing flour. Now they're told, no, you guys have been mistaken all these years. Your product is not flour, it's flour minus wheat. Well, who's producing the flour they thought they had been producing, but now allegedly are not? The wheat farmer. So one confusion is that your suppliers are producing part of your product instead of you. And what are you supposedly producing besides your value added, or your product added? The product of your customers. We have this confusion. It's thought the farmers are producing flour, the millers are producing bread, and also the farmers are thought to produce bread too. It's thought that the bread is the product of all the parties, that they're all producing the bread. The contribution of the baker is bread minus flour. The contribution of the miller is flour minus wheat. The contribution of the farmer is wheat.
Wait, if the mill produces the bread, then what does the baker produce?
The bread minus the flour. The baker produces bread minus flour. The miller, flour minus wheat. The wheat farmer, wheat. Yes, Mr. Drew.
Can I ask a really silly question?
That's okay.
Which is the right?
Pardon me?
Which which is the right one, which is the most generally accepted.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have to make a distinction between the most generally accepted and the right one.
Okay.
The most generally accepted is, the generally accepted conception within contemporary economics is that the producers are producing their net products, and that it is a positive error to say that they're producing their actual gross products. Who knows what the error is called of attempting to calculate the gross product as the sum of the bread, flour, and wheat?
I think you mean that if you count each product,
yeah,
that means that you count twice.
Yeah, it's alleged that if you count the value of the bread, the flour, and the wheat, all three, that you're then double counting. That's held to be the error of double counting. Why is that considered double counting?
Because then two people are making the bread.
By me?
Because each of the preceding products goes into the next one.
It's argued that the bread counts everything. That when you count bread, you're already counting the flour and the wheat. In the mere act of counting the bread, you're counting the flour and the wheat, and therefore, to count not only the bread, but also the flour and the wheat, that allegedly means you're double counting, since it's already counted in the bread. Yes?
Doesn't that not account for, like, wheat that doesn't go into bread, or flour that doesn't go into bread?
There might be some wheat that doesn't go into flour, and some flour that doesn't go into wheat. Then it's either in inventory, it could be in addition to the inventory, or it's in something else, and then some of the flour goes into crackers. Well, then we're counting crackers as final product. The argument is that the gross product is counted by the final product. Now, let me find some additional quotations on this, if I can.
But would that underestimate it, though, in a way that, because since we don't know what the values are, let's say in that chart that you had, if the bread was at the end, so let's say it's 100 loaves of bread.
Yeah.
But is the wheat and the flour only added to it to produce the bread what is needed for it, or that there is, say, 100 pounds of flour, 100 pounds of wheat, plus 100 loaves of bread that you may have excess left over? So if you've only counted in what was produced, still have this other goods that have been produced. You just may not have consumed
them. Now you're talking about inventories. I think you're talking about
even in your production line there. Is the assumption there that you've got wheat, you've got flour, and you've got bread?
The idea is to measure production, the production going on within a period of time.
But it's only that which is used to produce the needed.
But the question is, how do we measure the production? Now, the current production does not incorporate the existing accumulated assets that were already present. What you would count is additions to those assets, but not the assets themselves. Yes, Mr. Drew.
This is just applying to actual production situations, not like a distribution channel where a wholesaler is buying a product and then in turn selling it to a retailer. And there's really nothing really added to it. The product's not changed in any way. It's just changing hands in the distribution channel. I mean, is that, my question is, like, do wholesalers count their sales towards GDP, or how is that related?
But not only are the sales of the wholesalers not counted in GDP, but neither are the sales of any of the processors or the farmers or the raw materials makers or anyone except the sellers of the ultimate consumer's good. GDP, this is why I said almost on the opening night that GDP is essentially just consumption. It's not 100% consumption, but consumption is on the order of at least 85% of it. Yes, Mr. Alekhines.
I'm having a hard time grasping how the net national product would account for all the items already included, when sometimes it seems there would be some errors when the products within the final finished good would have some kind of synergistic effect to make the end result more valuable than the sum of the whole.
Well, the end result presumably will be more valuable. That will be value added.
Okay.
The final product is the sum of all of the values added along the way. But the question is, the real question that we want to deal with is, what is the gross product? What is the gross product? And in contemporary economics, it's considered a positive error to view the gross product as the classical economists viewed it, and as I view it, it's thought that's the error of double counting. And let me give you some other quotations. A very prominent textbook is that of Samuelson and Nordhaus. Samuelson has been around since shortly after World War II. He's probably now in his 90s. For many, many years, his was far and away the most popular textbook. And now, since my voice is fading a little, I'd appreciate it if someone else would take the job of quoting this paragraph here, starting with what is GNP. Today we say GDP, until a few years ago it was GNP, gross national versus gross domestic product. So who would be kind enough to read this paragraph?
What is GNP, they ask. And the answer, it is the name we give to the total dollar value of the goods and services produced by a nation during a given year.
Okay, now just keep that in mind. It's supposed to be the total dollar value of the goods and services produced by a nation in a year. That's reasonable. I would agree with that. Okay, would you please continue, Mr. Sadowski?
And then 4 pages later, they declare GNP, or gross national product, can be measured as the flow of final products. Indeed, so as to leave absolutely no doubt about it, they emphatically declare that GNP excludes intermediate goods, i.e. ones that are used up to produce other goods. GNP hence includes bread but not wheat, and cars but not steel.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, just pause on that for a moment. What we're being told, GNP includes and excludes. Here it's supposed to be the total output of the economy in a year. Now, a simple question. Did we produce only cars last year, or did we also produce some steel? Did we also produce some iron ore? Well, if these things were produced and we want to have a concept of gross product, mustn't we include them? Yes. How can we have a concept of gross product if all we include is the cars? That's not gross. That could be net, but it's not gross. The gross product includes everything. It's the cars, the steel, the iron ore, it's the bread, the flour, and the wheat, not just the bread and the cars. The gross product is the total of all of the outputs. Now, let me come back to the supplement. I've already indicated when I talk about nonsensical implications about what producers produce, the bakery is allegedly not producing bread, but bread minus flour. I imagine that these economists, they don't write books, they write the difference between books and paper. When their wives make them dinner, they're not making them roast beef, they're making the difference between a cooked and raw roast beef. This is what's implied. Now, this idea, there's an approach, you see, you start off with this confusion of thinking that what the producer is producing is not his actual tangible physical product, but a concept. You're thinking that what he's producing is the difference between the product and the previously purchased means used up, the bread minus the flour. That's the idea. Well, starting with that, we've seen how if you add the sum of these product differences, the sum of the net products, like over here, X1 plus Y1 minus X1 plus Z1 minus Y1 up on that top line, we end up with Z1. All right, that's true. Now, the way that contemporary economists are conceiving the Z1, they're thinking of it as these three expressions together. They're thinking of the Z1, the bread, as being represented uh, the thinking of the bread as consisting of a series of abstractions. I'll rewrite the equation. It's x1 plus y1 minus x1 plus z1 minus y1. Add them all together, we have z1, right? And I think what they're doing is they're thinking of z1 as being this. They're thinking z1 is these three abstractions. Notice each of these things is an abstraction. This is minus zero. We have this is the net product of the former, x1 minus whatever he had, which we take as zero. The net product of the miller, y1 minus x1. The net product of the baker, z1 minus y1. And they're thinking of the bread as being constructed out of this. They're thinking, well, the bread is equal to this, and so it's essentially made up of this. This is what the bread consists of, the sum of these three abstractions. Yes, Mr. Joseph.
I think this concept of value added is widely used. A lot of businesses use this, and I think it probably evolved as a business concept more than an economics theory.
And yeah.
It's useful in business because it helps you look at what you can actually control.
Oh, it's useful. The concept of net product is useful. The identification of the gain from production, that's all useful. So I'm not disputing the validity of the concept of net product. I think that's fine. I use it wherever it's of any help. What I am disputing is the idea that the net product is the gross product. It's not. It's just the net product. Now, when you start to look at a final product as equal to a sum of product additions or product differences, a sum of net products, then, as I put it here in point A, the notion that the total product in the sense of total product additions or product differences is the final product supports the confusion that the final product is the total product in the sense not of mere product additions, but in the sense of actual physical entities. When you start thinking of bread this way, it's very easy, and I think happens again and again, to think of the bread as somehow being bread, flour, and wheat. It's very easy to think of the bread as being not just the bread, but also the flour and the wheat as well. Now let's see how that comes up. Can you guys see this in the rear? This down here?
Yeah.
Okay, in equation one, we're thinking of bread as equal to these three abstractions, parenthetically expressed, bread minus flour, flour minus wheat, wheat minus zero. And notice the placement of the brackets, a bracket here and a bracket here. I'm using the brackets to indicate that in this case, in this first formulation, equation one, that all three abstractions are being held together. They're all grouped within the brackets and they're being thought of as together. In that case, what does this sum to? What does this represent?
Bread.
So happily, bread equals bread. Hooray. But now let's turn to formulation two. We have the same terms as in formulation one. The only difference is I've removed this abstraction from inside the brackets. It's now outside the brackets. And what we're going to focus on is the flour minus wheat plus the wheat minus zero. And that's our emphasis. We're going to take our attention away from bread minus flour. We're going to put that on the back burner, so to speak, at the periphery of our consciousness. We're not going to pay any attention to it. And now we're zeroing in on these expressions within the brackets. What do they represent?
It's flour.
See, now we have the bread. Bread is equal to bread minus flour, plus flour minus wheat, plus wheat minus zero. Flour. The bread is equal to flour, and I say fade out. What does the fade out refer to? It's that we're not paying attention to this.
Bread.
We're saying the bread is the flour, plus something we don't have to pay much attention to. The bread is essentially the flour. And what do we do down here? We ignore the bread minus the flour, the flour minus the wheat, and we zero in on the wheat. So we said, bread, yeah, that counts the wheat, and fade out. And so what we're doing here is we're thinking of the bread as now being bread, and then equally being flour, and as also being wheat. We're thinking of the bread as being all three of these things. Now, this is illegitimate. Are we allowed to disregard any of these elements? If we recognize that we can stress the flour, what is a true formulation of this second equation? We could say the bread is equal to flour plus the contribution of the baker, plus the net product of the baker. If we insist on including the net product of the baker, then what is the bread equal to? If we don't allow this to fade out, if we insist on taking account of this,
flour plus bread.
It's bread. It's still just the bread. Yeah. The only way we can conceive of it as flour is if we're dropping away part of what it is. We have to disregard part of it. Then we think of it as flour. And here we're throwing away more. Now, exactly that procedure is what comes up in thinking that the monetary value of the final product somehow counts the value of everything else along the way. And let's see how this comes up.
Is that right or wrong?
What?
You just, the formula you showed us is the way it is right or wrong. It's wrong, right?
I'd say it's totally wrong. It's okay. Utterly illegitimate.
Okay.
Now,
is that right?
Now,
so therefore you're saying that really the end product is not the value of the sum of the values does not make the.
I was saying the value, the only thing that the value of the bread counts, as we'll see in a moment, is the value of the bread. And it can do so in a variety of ways, but it still counts only the value of the bread. And the notion that it counts anything in addition to that rests on violations of the laws of arithmetic, as we'll see. Let me turn to that right now. I say that it's on this basis that we've just run through that the value of the loaf of bread appears to count the value of the loaf of bread, the value of the flour from which it was made, the value of the wheat from which the flour was made, and so on. And I say, and on this basis, counting the value of the bread, the flour, and the wheat separately appears to imply double counting the value of these things. Let's work this out in actual detail. Here we are, we have, this is Professor Reynolds' example. I'm using his numbers, as you can verify easily. We have the value of bread at retail. And we're told by Professor Reynolds that we have a number of stages. You read most of his discussion. A wheat farmer produces a quantity of wheat worth $100. A flour miller takes that wheat and produces flour worth $150. A baker takes the flour, produces bread worth $2.25, and then that bread, this is bread at wholesale, it's sold for $2.25 to a retailer who sells it for $300. So this is Reynolds' exact example. And here we are, the value of the bread at retail is $300, and notice that it equals the sum of these four expressions. What's the value added by the retailer?
$75,
the value added by the baker. 75, so far that's 150. The value added by the miller? 50, so that's 200. And the value added by the farmer? 100, so it'll add to 300, right? Okay, so now here we're keeping everything together. And so the value of a quantity of bread at retail is equal to the value of a quantity of bread at retail. It's counting the value of the bread at retail. Now in formulation two, we're showing all of the same numbers, but we're removing this first expression from inside the brackets, and that means we're going to put our primary focus here. This is what we're going to look at. And when we add these items up, what will they equal? And 225 is what? It's the value of the bread at wholesale. It's the value of the bread at wholesale. And so here we are. The value of a quantity of bread at retail equals, and we're stressing, the value of the bread at wholesale. And then down here in formulation three, we have the value of the bread at retail. What are we stressing here?
The value of the flour.
The value of the flour. And then finally down here, we're stressing the value of the wheat. Now, notice, is it correct to say that the value of the bread at retail is equal to the value of the bread at retail plus the value of the bread at wholesale plus the value of the flour plus the value of the wheat? In reality, in each of these four formulations, if we don't throw away any parts of the equation, if we keep all of the terms present as we're obliged to do, what is this actually equal to if we count this expression which has been ignored? We can say the value of the bread at retail is equal to the value of the bread at wholesale, but what do we have to add in if we're not throwing away anything? Yes? Plus this 75, plus the value added by the retailer. You see, it's true to say the value of the bread at retail is equal to, one, the value of the bread at retail. Two, it's equal to the value of the bread at wholesale plus the value added by the retailer. Now, if we say that, that's fine. But if we say that, then what is the value of the bread at retail still equal to?
The value of the bread at retail.
Just the value of the bread at retail. It's the value of the bread at retail is equal to the value of the bread at wholesale plus the value added by the retailer, which means it's equal to the value of the bread at retail. Now we can also say the value of the bread at retail is equal to the value of the flour plus the value added by the baker and the value added by the retailer. Well, if we keep these two terms in mind, what is the value of the bread at retail still equal to?
The value of the bread at retail.
Just the value of the bread at retail. And finally, we can say the value of the bread at retail is equal to the value of the wheat, but not just the value of the wheat, it's the value of the wheat plus the value added by the miller, plus the value added by the baker, plus the value added by the retailer, which is the value of the bread at retail. We can express the value of the bread at retail in four different ways, but still, what is it in every formulation? It's just the value of the bread at retail. Have we counted anything but the value of the bread at retail? No. But what is done in contemporary economics is, A, they throw away these parts of equations, and then they add up the remainder. And they think, well, the value of the bread at retail counts, one, the value of the bread at retail, two, the value of the bread at wholesale, three, the value of the flour, four, the value of the wheat. The value of the bread at retail counts everything. But it doesn't. It just counts itself. The only way we can come to the conclusion that it counts any more than itself is by illegitimately throwing away these expressions and then adding up the remainders. And you have no right to add up these things. These are mutually exclusive alternative formulations of the same basic fact. And you can't add up mutually exclusive formulations. I'll give you one last example here. If we add up 1 plus 2 plus 3, it's 6, right? Now, one way to express this is we have parenthesis, 1 plus 2 plus 3, close parenthesis. That's 6, right? And now we could also say that 6 is equal to 1 outside the parenthesis plus 2 plus 3 inside the parenthesis. Does that mean that 6 is 5? 6 is still just 6. And even if 5, if 6 were the value of bread and 5 the value of wheat, the 6 is not counting the value of the flour. The 6 is not counting the value of the flour. It's the 5 value of the flour plus 1, which means it's just counting 6. We can formulate 6 in three different ways. 1 plus 2 plus 3 all in parentheses, 1 outside, 2 plus 3 in, 1 and 2 outside, 3 in. But in all these cases, what is 6 equal to?
6.
6. And then we can't throw terms away. We can't say 6 equals 6. Now, 6 is 5. And now 6 is 3. And we'll add the 3, the 5, and the 6. That's illegitimate. Yes, Ms. Bonneau.
Is the point of this that you believe that we're overstating
10 to GNP?
No, we're radically understating it.
You think we're understating
it? No, radically understating it. Yeah, we're just, the idea of gross national product today is essentially just the production of consumers' goods. It's not seeing the total economy.
All of
the production. Yeah, macroeconomics, if we're looking at the economy as a whole, we can't deal just with the production of bread and automobiles. We also need to deal with the production of flour, wheat, steel, and iron ore. We have to be considering the totality. But that is not done.
And if it were, we would have...
Well, if it were, the number would be much, much greater. But what's important is not the number. It's not the size of the dollars, but the way that we think about the economy. We have to realize that there is a production of capital goods, that it's essential that we be producing capital goods, that a major part of economic activity needs to be involved in the production of capital goods, that we're not producing just consumer goods. And this will lead us to a very, very different conception of what determines spending. What do you think is viewed as virtually the totality of spending on this conception of what's produced? It's just consumer spending. The focus of today's macroeconomics is almost entirely just on consumer spending. But the reality is that most spending in the economic system is not consumption expenditure, but productive expenditure, which doesn't even get considered. And this is, I say finally here, contemporary Keynesian economics confusions about double counting and its belief that the final product counts the total product, that it is the total product, leads it to ignore most spending in the economic system, along with most of production.
That's wrong.
And that's profoundly wrong. If we want to have a concept of the total economy, its total production, total spending, it's grossly inadequate to think that total production is just the production of consumers' goods. We're ignoring most of production, and we're ignoring most of spending. And we'll see that most spending, as I say, is a productive expenditure, not consumption expenditure. And our first subject next week will be aggregate spending, what is bought when it is bought. And there are very profound confusions here that are not only in contemporary economics, but that most people walking the street have. There are huge confusions about what it is that you buy when you buy it.